This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Ja, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, the return of the threat of US tariffs on Canada and Mexico. The Washington Post, led in a new editorial direction by its billionaire owner.
What's at issue here is whether a newspaper like the Washington Post should allow a wide variety of opinions on its pages in a country where there are a wide variety of opinions.
Also, the boost for arms dealers from the current surge in defense spending and Pokemon's 29th birthday. We hear from Pokemon's boss. But first, tariffs are back on the table. President Trump says the delayed 25% markups on goods coming into the US from Canada and Mexico will now come into effect on March the 4th. And there will be an additional tariff of 10% on Chinese goods on top of the 10% already imposed. Donald Trump says Mexico and Canada have failed to do enough to curb the drug fentanyl coming over their borders into the US. But will these tariffs be delayed yet again? I asked our North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury.
Look, between now and then, there is always time for a deal to be done. The president, though, has said at the moment, as things currently stand, both countries haven't done enough to stop the flow of fentanyl into the United States. And so, as we are speaking, it does look like it will go ahead. But again, there's always a deal to be done with this very transactional White House.
Yeah, and President Sheinbaum in Mexico certainly seems to think it won't, that something else could be happening, she said, before March the 4th. I mean, what is the wiggle room? Is it just about fentanyl?
On the surface, that is what the president has said. He repeated that in a social media post this morning on Truth Social. But at the same time, when he talks more generally about tariffs, he always gives lots of reasons for why he likes them. In particular, one of them is the trade deficit. He said it's about balancing the books, that the US is getting a raw deal from other countries, and he plans to level the playing field, as he says. And in his eyes, that's what tariffs do. And when he was talking yesterday about the EU, one of the things he cited was his frustration that products like American cars and agricultural products don't go into the EU more, in part because the EU levies higher tariffs on US goods. And so that's what he's trying to kind of change. Now, there's obviously lots of economic arguments about how effective they are, whether or not they drive up inflation, but that seems to be a lot of the rationale. And so given that, it's hard to see what terms Canada and Mexico can provide that satisfy that.
And you mentioned the EU. They certainly seem to be next in line in the firing line, don't they?
I mean, 25% tariffs is what he mentioned this week. That's the first time he put a number on it. No more specific details were given, no timing on that. But I think as we kind of look at tariffs, there are a couple of dates to focus on. March 4th is the most pressing one. Obviously, we were talking about that with Mexico and Canada. The next one is the beginning of April. That's when reciprocal tariffs go into effect. It's also when a review into kind of tariffs and trade is meant to be concluded by the White House, you know, one of those early executive orders. And so that's where you could see a lot of movement as well.
And from potential tariffs to actual existing tariffs, 10% on Chinese goods, now an additional 10%.
Yeah, I think that caught people off guard when he announced it in this social media post this morning. People were wondering, did he really mean an extra 10%? And it does appear so. It's hard to know what effect this will have. Obviously, the initial 10% that went in about 3 weeks or so ago, we haven't really seen the impact of that yet filter down to consumers. An extra 10% on top of that, we'll have to wait and see. We'll also have to wait and see how China responds if it does go ahead.
And better news, I suppose, for the UK, because certainly from the press conference between Prime Minister Keir Starmer and President Trump seemed to suggest, President Trump seemed to be suggesting perhaps not tariffs on UK and perhaps an actual trade deal.
Yeah, I mean, this is the elusive US-UK trade deal that we've seen various prime ministers come to the US and trying to push that both with the Obama administration, with Biden administration, and with previous Trump administration. This time, the mood music coming out of the joint press conference, very upbeat, with Donald Trump saying that he hoped to have an economic deal soon, that there was a huge possibility. The UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer saying it would probably be focused around technology with AI at its heart, that that was where the two countries had a lot in common. And Donald Trump even saying that that might be a way the UK could sidestep tariffs as part of this sort of big deal. So some good news, certainly better news than perhaps other leaders have had recently when it comes to the tariff front.
Michel Fleury, but less good mood music currently for Mexico. What's the view then from there? I spoke to the former Deputy Finance Minister, Vanessa Rubio.
I think that it's likely in the way that it happened last time around. Last time around, it was exactly the same threat in relation to the implementation of the tariffs. And then a series of negotiations and a series of conversations happened, which culminated with the conversation between both presidents. And then the implementation of the tariffs was delayed. Today, there is a huge delegation of Mexican officials in Washington, D.C., including the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Minister of Economy, the Minister of Defense, the Minister of the Navy, the Minister of Security, and of course, another series of high-level officials, also the Minister of Finance, that are having conversations regarding how to anchor, which I think is the most important thing, Roger, how to anchor conversations with the United States in relation to specific metrics. You cannot have a conversation and you cannot have a negotiation in the abstract. You need to know exactly what numbers, what data, what metrics would be measured and would be taken into account in order for those tariffs not to be implemented.
But Vanessa, the metric that Donald Trump certainly has been pushing out is that Mexico hasn't enough to restrict the flow of the drug fentanyl into the US from Mexico. He says there's not enough progress. I mean, are the Mexicans making progress?
That's exactly what I was referring to, Roger. What is not enough? You need to put that on the table. What would be enough in relation to the US government today to say that Mexico is advancing in addressing the fentanyl problem and addressing organized crime and addressing migration? These are the very specific negotiations that need to take place, because let's remember that we don't have currently a trade negotiation with the United States. It's basically one that is concentrated on security and on migration. So it is those metrics that I think is what the ministers today are negotiating in order for those tariffs not to be implemented.
But isn't it more likely that if there is another delay for another 4 weeks, that's the way it's going to keep going? You'll have a delay and all your importers and exporters will have to operate under the assumption that in just a few weeks' time, there could actually be 25% tariffs, and it'll just make it really difficult to do business.
Roger, this is exactly what happened last time around. I was Deputy Minister of Finance, and we were negotiating USMCA back then with a constant threat that back then NAFTA was going to be canceled. It was exactly the same thing, and the peso would go up and down in a day, and in an intraday, it would lose significant value. But it was precisely that way in which we negotiated USMCA. So this is basically back to the future.
But as you know, Donald Trump will say things, not necessarily things that are clear, perhaps, in terms of what has to happen. It's almost more in his interest to keep you guys on edge all the time and constantly having to do his bidding.
But at the same time, the fact that you need to provide for a certainty environment in Mexico is also very important, and is very important for the United States as well. Mexico is the first trading partner of the United States, the first source of its imports. It's the 15th largest economy in the world, and the majority of its states have Mexico as main trading partner. So I think it is also important for the U.S. in the medium term, hopefully sooner than later, that enabling environment for investment and for normal trade relations takes place. So that is also to consider.
Is it really, though, a negotiation? Because it feels at the moment as if Donald Trump, the Americans, demand something and President Sheinbaum basically has to do it. It's a one-way trade, in effect.
Having been there in those negotiations, I can tell you that it is a negotiation. And one thing is the rhetoric, and one thing is what both presidents say to their political base and to their electoral base, which, of course, is important in part of real politics. But the other thing is what happens really in the negotiating table. And I am sure that there are negotiations going on.
Vanessa Rubio there, the former Deputy Finance Minister of Mexico. Well, let's turn now to Kerry Leahy, economist at Columbia University. Kerry, thanks for being with us. Well, with all that doubt about tariffs, because there's certainly a lot of skepticism, I think, that these tariffs will come in on March the 4th. How did the markets pick that up?
They did not like it. This was a real Debbie Downer day for the marketplace, down 0.5% on the Dow Jones, 1.5% on the S&P, and a whopping almost 3% on NASDAQ. So the very fact that the well-known technology executive from HP said that tariffs may cut into our business, we're the consumer of a lot of stuff that's going to be imported, was certainly bad news for the market. I just think the fact that it's not only the tariffs that could be bad for the United States and our trading partners, but the fact that the prospect of those tariffs on and off makes planning very difficult, and people just want to stick their heads in the sand and wait it out.
Yeah, meanwhile, there was some other interesting data on the economy in the U.S. Jobless claims up, the monthly figures. I mean, what is that going to suggest? I mean, we're going to get inflation data tomorrow, which perhaps is a more concrete thing to cling to. But what do you reckon to the labor market?
Well, the weekly claims figures are starting to get very interesting, sadly, because they are starting to show some seepage from the layoffs in Washington. You saw that in the D.C. Metropolitan area, though it didn't get into Virginia or Maryland too badly. With the threat of, you know, hundreds of thousands of layoffs among government workers, you have a multiplier effect that could make the market quite weak, and you could get quite a few layoffs. So I think, unfortunately, the direction on claims right now is up, not down. And even though it's admittedly a low level, the trend is not your friend. And I think it's another thing that bothers the market.
Yeah, Kerry, that is really interesting. So it's the squeezing of the federal employees that may actually be something that quite damages the economy.
Oh, absolutely, because we're going to find out the hard way whether or not we don't need all these employees. And if you end up having a situation where someone normally gets a payment from the government, should it be a farmer, he gets it in June, and now he's going to get it in September, that's a mess. So you're going to see whether or not they're going to be able to produce the deliverables with a smaller workforce.
And that data coming out tomorrow, the inflation data, what's the expectation?
Well, I think that, I mean, there's some nervousness there, but I think most people are expecting the inflation figures to be relatively stable. It's going to be awfully hard to get the number down a full half to a full percentage point back to where the Fed really wants it.
It's going to be interesting to see. Well, let's talk about a company anyway that's had an interesting ride. NVIDIA is what I'm talking about. And we've spoken about it before, Kerry. And when the whole DeepSeek thing came in, the Chinese AI thing that seemed to get much cheaper, much easier than everything else, NVIDIA had a rough ride. Now, they've got a fairly weak quarterly forecast just come out. I mean, what is going on with NVIDIA?
Well, I mean, the numbers were still reasonably impressive. They did have strong demand, and obviously the stock's under pressure because you think maybe AI is being overhyped and there may be a low-cost alternative from China. But I thought the numbers were actually pretty good, but the market was looking for something better, and with worries about tariffs, they just used as another excuse to sell off a bit.
But the whole tech sector is certainly, I mean, had a rough ride, as I said, after DeepSeek. But do you get a sense that it's settling now, that perhaps there's a feeling that it's not the apocalypse that many people thought it would be?
Absolutely. You have not had a follow-up punch from the initial rollout of this low-cost Chinese alternative. So I think, yes, I think there's probably going to be a little bit of stability there. I mean, these numbers are stretched and the like, but it's one of those things that you don't – this could be one of the great innovations of the next 50 years, and investors want to be a part of that ride.
And no doubt we'll be talking about it. Kerry, thank you so much for being with us. Kerry Leahy there, the economist at Columbia University.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.
The following feature is paid and presented by the Department for Business and Trade. Welcome to the United Kingdom, where the brightest tech innovators reshaping our world are celebrated. This year, the Department for Business and Trade are spotlighting global, trailblazing entrepreneurs through the Unicorn Kingdom Pathfinder Awards. The winner of the Digital Trade Solutions category was GrubTech. Hear from the co-founder, Mohammed Hamidi.
GrubTech initially was launched to tackle the food and beverage space to empower these enterprises to meet the challenges of new customer behaviors, meaning previously most of the business was dine-in. Today, most of it is through delivery, some sort of digital channels. We came about to enable restaurants and cloud kitchens to service, be able to receive these orders, centrally manage their menus across multiple channels, be able to process this order, and then send that out to a last mile delivery or fulfillment service to deliver to the customer. Winning the Unicorn Kingdom Pathfinder Award is a great recognition for my team, all the hard work that we've done and that brought us to this point today. The opportunity of bringing GrubTech into UK is we recognize that establishing a model that will work in the UK is easily replicatable, the launching pad for us to go globally.
From cutting-edge AI to digital trade solutions, these innovators are building tomorrow's world today. Learn how the United Kingdom supports tech pioneers at great.gov.uk/UKPA.
Now, you're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, let's talk about newspapers, and one particular newspaper, the Washington Post. It's one of the world's great papers, famous above all for its Watergate expose that brought down President Richard Nixon back in the 70s, and a strong liberal voice in the US media landscape. It was bought by the billionaire Jeff Bezos back in 2013, and now, to some of its staff at least, he's turning it into a less liberal institution. He's declared that the paper will, in future, only publish opinion pieces that support, and I quote, personal liberties and free markets. Well, coming after Jeff Bezos blocked the paper endorsing Kamala Harris in the presidential election, some see him taking the paper now in a very different direction. I got the view of the man who was the paper's executive editor until 2021, Martin Barron.
Well, I'm not sure I've seen any opinion on the page that suggested that they were against personal liberties, but obviously he seems to think so. And apparently he's defining personal liberties in a way that's different from the way that I define it, and maybe a lot of other people define it. Of course, we're all in favor of personal liberties. It's in the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, where it talks about free expression. And one thing that news organizations have done over decades and decades is that they've honored and fostered free expression by allowing a whole variety of opinions and vigorous debate on their opinion pages. And now Bezos is shutting that down. I see that as a betrayal of the very idea of free expression, which is the most fundamental personal liberty of American citizens.
But in the end, he's the owner. He bought the paper. People have worked with him there for a little bit. I mean, he's entitled to do that, isn't he?
Well, I mean, he has the editorial page. He can control the editorials. If he wants the editorials to express his view of the world, then of course he's entitled to do that. But what he's saying now is that that the entire opinion department, that there won't be any opinions expressed on the opinion pages or in the opinion section online that are not reflective of his own personal point of view. And that's an outrage. I mean, that is actually anti-democratic. So here's a news organization that has as its mission statement, democracy dies in darkness. Bezos has talked often about democracy, but this is anti-democracy because democracy calls for a vigorous public debate. And he's sending a message that really is anything but democratic. He's saying that other opinions shouldn't see the light of day.
Well, you wrote the memoir, of course, Collision of Power, Trump, Bezos, and the Washington Post. Were you surprised that Jeff Bezos has done this now?
I've been concerned for a while now, that for months now, that he's yielding to pressure from Donald Trump. That was evident, it seemed to me, when he decided 11 days before the presidential election last year that the Post, for the first time in almost 50 years, would not run an editorial of endorsement for president. But then he made a donation to the inauguration of Trump. He sat on the dais sitting right behind Donald Trump, which was not a sign of independence, certainly not anything that enhanced the credibility of the Washington Post. I didn't expect that someone who, over the years, I've heard say that he would like to see a wide variety of opinions on the op-ed page. And because I think he wanted more conservative voices, and I think that's fine. Conservatism is a big movement in this country, and people have a variety of opinions, and they should be reflected in the Washington Post. But to say that only one set of opinions should appear in the Washington Post, I certainly did not expect him to say that. I've never seen Bezos interfere in the news coverage. What's at issue here is whether a newspaper like the Washington Post should allow a wide variety of opinions on its pages in a country where there are a wide variety of opinions.
Well, Marty, you referenced the Heritage, and of course, perhaps the most famous or recent part of the Heritage is, of course, the Watergate investigation, Woodward and Bernstein in the early 70s. They struggled to get that in the paper then, though it did run. Could you see something anti-Trump in that way, that it was anti-Nixon, could get into the paper now?
Oh, sure. I mean, much of the coverage over the last month has been aggressive. It's been tough on Trump. It's showing what's really happening behind the scenes of this administration. I'm sure that Trump does not like this coverage. He's been critical. He attacks Washington Post reporters as he attacks all reporters. So I have not seen Bezos interfere at all in the news coverage, and I'm really grateful for that. Obviously, there's concern about that at the paper, that might change, but I don't see any evidence that it has to date. So, yeah, I do think they could do that kind of coverage today, and they would do that kind of coverage because the news department works independently.
Former editor of the Washington Post, Martin Barron. Now, the world seems to be getting more dangerous, and as European and other nations step up their defence spending, the global arms industry is benefiting. Share prices for arms manufacturers have gone up on both sides of the Atlantic. I've been talking to someone who knows the industry well, David Pacuse. Now, he's an American former arms dealer as well as a convicted fraudster. In 2007, he was part of a group that won a $300 million contract to supply munitions to Afghanistan. He was part of a cover-up to disguise the true identity of the ammunition, that it was of Chinese origin. And he ended up being sentenced to 7 months house arrest and a 15-year arms dealing ban. I spoke to him earlier and he told me how he thought arms dealers would deal with what's happening now.
Because of the current unstable geopolitical situation and the state of international alliances, people are looking to be more self-reliant, and that is a boon for the international arms industry.
And where will the money be going mostly, do you think? U.S. arms firms, European ones, maybe outside that area?
As usual, it will be a mixture of things. The state of conflict is changing, so different companies are going to benefit to different levels. Smaller companies that are making more drones and autonomous systems are set to benefit quite a lot in the coming years. Companies like Anduril in the United States are expanding quite rapidly, and there's a few drone companies in Europe as well. Ukraine, of course, having quite a lot of experience in this area. So their arms industry is set to thrive, not just to support themselves, but in the long term, the international market.
Are companies coming to you for advice on all this? Because suddenly, well, given the fact that Britain, for example, diverting a lot of aid money now into defence, but the US clearly building up defence and European countries doing the same, you have experience. Are they coming to say, how do we do it?
Well, it's definitely a topic of incredible concern to the international community because nobody is really sure where the current international alliances will stand in the near future, because of the changing geopolitical situation. So quite a lot of uncertainty. And people are hedging their bets. That's really what it's about. And there's a large element of opportunity in the private sector and a large element of fear in the public sector. And when those things combined, it really propels the industry forward.
And we're talking as if it's all, you know, bullets and bombs and tanks. But of course, there's an awful lot that goes into defense that's rather more mundane than that, isn't it?
Yeah, when a country needs to be involved in a conflict, it's not just the weapons. They need to support their soldiers in all manner. It's logistics is actually where quite a lot of, if not most of the funding goes to. They need to be able to provide transportation and food and fuel and even entertainment services for their troops on the ground. It's a whole wide support system that they need to build up. And that is something that most people don't take into account in the defense industry, is what a wide variety of things the defense industry needs to buy to support their soldiers and their staff members, because it's not just weapons that moves an army forward. As Napoleon said, an army marches on its stomach.
And we're talking as if it's like the manufacturers produce it and give it or sell it to the governments. But of course, there are loads of middlemen in between all this, and sourcing bullets, bombs, whatever it is quite a complicated business and can be quite politically, well, touchy.
Yeah, the defense industry is very sensitive to politics because, of course, countries don't want to be supporting their enemies. And so they put quite severe restrictions on what kind of business their citizens and companies can do and who they can sell things to. As business people, they just want to make money. So they are happy to sell to whoever they're legally allowed to. It's really up to the politicians and the national and international organizations to decide, you know, who they are comfortable allowing the private sector to sell to.
And that was David Pakuz, the former arms dealer. Now it's Pokemon's birthday, the Japanese pocket monster cartoon franchise that captured the world over the last 29 years. And not just the children. But what is the secret to Pokemon's success? Mariko Oi caught up with the boss of the Pokemon Company.
I'm at one of two dozen Pokemon centres around the world where they sell toys, stationeries, cars, you name it. Since Pocket Monsters was released in a red and green version for the Game Boy in Japan 29 years ago, their popularity hasn't died down. The phenomenon has been dubbed Pokemania, and what looks like a simple card game can be sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars, or reportedly even millions. So what's the secret to their success? I put that question to the president of the Pokemon company, Tsunekazu Ishihara.
I believe the original game was groundbreaking because it allowed users to exchange Pokemon that you catch with your friends and other players. So it wasn't an introverted activity, but it became a tool to actively communicate with others. The number of Pokemon, which started at 151, has increased to more than 1,000 today, and their fans also grew and now span across several generations. Our mission statement is to enrich both the real world and the virtual world with the Pokemon characters. Pokemon Go is the perfect example, because you can look for Pokemon in the real world.
What about counterfeits and patent infringement? You recently sued the maker of the hit survival adventure game, Pal World. What are you doing about those fake Pokemon?
We've been fighting fakes since the beginning. The more popular Pokemon became, the worse the problem. It affects our creativity, and our customers get disappointed when they receive products that aren't authentic.
And that's not their only challenge. Pokemon cards are sold for a price tag of six or even seven figures, with influencer Logan Paul currently holding the Guinness World Records for the most expensive Pokemon trading card, which he bought for more than $5 million.
If the cards are rare or seen as vintage, their value goes up. But it's not our place to say that they are not valuable. To us, the true value of Pokemon is to play, have fun, and communicate with friends.
Along with Hello Kitty and Super Mario, Pokemon is one of Japan's three big soft power, and the Pokemon Company is the only one that remains private despite its huge revenue. But Mr. Ishihara says that's not the biggest difference.
Hello Kitty is one of the characters for Sanrio, and Super Mario is one of the characters for Nintendo. But Pokemon is the only thing we do at the Pokemon Company. So whatever profit we make from Pokemon gets reinvested in Pokemon. If we go public, we have to focus on growing our profitability. And our investors might ask, what are you going to do when the popularity of Pokemon dies down? And our answer will be, we'll go bust when Pokemon is no longer popular.
Now here's my full disclosure. I bid for Mr. Ishihara's interview when I realized how popular Pokemon is among my children and their friends. And they were shocked to learn that Ash and Pikachu, who were the beloved protagonists of the Pokemon anime for more than a quarter of a century, had to retire. So I asked Mr. Ishihara what happened to them.
That's the hardest question you asked today. Well, Ash and Pikachu's journey might have ended on camera, but it's only what you see on TV. Even though the TV camera might not be following them, Ash's journey is continuing and his partner Pikachu is right next to him.
That report by Mariko Oi. That's it from World Business Report.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.